I am very happy to give you Håkon Byum Lie.
Thank you, Hans. Indeed, it's a great space. Take a look around while you're here. There's offices all around. There's a lot of things happening. But the most important thing happening here today is this meeting. We have an honored guest, which I will use a few minutes to say something about. You should prepare for a life-changing event. It's not going to happen to all of you. For some of you, it's just going to be entertainment, Friday night and all of that. But for some of you, I believe it's going to change your life. I've had a couple of those changes happening. And one of them, I brought this book along today to show it to you, was when reading Hackers. It's a well-worn copy. It came out in 1984. It described not just computers and the history of computing, but also the ethics involved in this. How the communities form inside those machines. How things changed when you're networked. And this is what I hope John Perry will talk more about today, expand on. I know he's well aware of this book as well. He references in one of his early messages. And that's another change for me. During the summer of 1990, I was a graduate student. And I was on these mailing lists, and one of them came on the 13th of June, and it warned me that this was a very long article. It said long in capital letters, as you can see. And it was called Crime and Puzzlement by John Perry Barlow. And I'll show you exactly how long it is. I mean, this is in the world of ASCII, right? He basically filled up the internet at the time. It wasn't that big. I mean, 1990, some of you probably weren't even born at the time, right? There we are, written on June 8th. And here John describes the background, what happened, what led up to the formation of what was called the Computer Liberty Foundation in this message, which later became the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Which I think is a very good name. I think getting the word frontier in there was a nice change, something that is very significant to Americans, of course, but which others also can relate to. And today we have John Perry Barlow with us today. He will expand on the topic of who has sovereignty of cyberspace. I'm very excited to learn what the outcome of that's going to be. Is it going to be Google or Apple? You know? Maybe even Microsoft is there, or Amazon. These are all West Coast American companies. I would be much too modest to mention any software companies around here. But I will mention two Norwegian organizations which are sponsoring this event today. One is Elektronisk for Post Norge, which is almost a direct translation of Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have been active in Norway since 1994, so we started a few years after EFF, inspired by the same ideas and drawing upon the writings of John and others in the EFF. The other one is the Pirate Party, which is a political party that we're trying to start in Norway. There will be a signature sheet being tossed around, handed out by Guy here. We're trying to collect 5,000 signatures in order to get the party listed in the registry. In order to run for parliamentary elections, you need to have 5,000 signatures on paper. On paper. Did you get that? Right? So that means we have to have a lot of gatherings like this, and I hope many of you will support us. You're not signing up to be members of the party. You're not going to have the police come to your door. This is just saying, I'd like the Pirate Party to be able to run for elections. Okay? With that, not much more from me. John, it's all yours.
Thanks. Now, I hope actually to prevent myself from being too self-indulgent and to make this as much a conversation as possible. I'd rather talk with you than at you. But to frame things a little bit, let me give you some of my own story. how we all came to be here, at least from my trajectory. For a good many years, I was a cattle rancher in Wyoming, which is the last of the American frontier, unless you count Alaska, which is pretty uninhabitable. My family had always been frontier people, and they had found themselves in the upper reaches of the Green River Basin in Wyoming in the 1870s, when my great-great-uncle was the first white man to ever spend a winter there. And I had grown up feeling a kind of restlessness about the fact that I was not going to be permitted to be a pioneer in the same way that my forebears had been since the, really going all the way back to the 17th century. But I was ranching, I was in a condition where law was less important than honor, where there actually was something called the Code of the West, but it had never been written down, and most everybody understood it. I don't think I ever heard of anybody actually serving time for murder in Wyoming, or in my part of Wyoming, because what would happen is that people believed in justifiable homicide, and they also believed that no man knew another man's business. So all you had to do really was to convict the deceased, who wasn't defended anyway. And that usually worked, and there weren't very many killings where you couldn't get a jury to agree that the deceased probably needed killing. But it was that kind of place, and it still is to a certain extent. We didn't like government, we didn't like law, we were relatively free. And that was the backdrop, cultural backdrop, that I was coming from when, as a... Where is that coming from?
Street.
Boy, I hope they get it sorted out.
It's a rough place here, too.
So I see. But in the middle 80s, I was also writing for a rock and roll band called The Grateful Dead. And I was thinking a lot about little agricultural towns like mine and what was going to happen to them as family farming and ranching became insupportable, which it appeared to be, and what would happen to community in America. And I was looking around for new forms of community. Come on in. There's room in the back. I was looking around for new forms of community in America, and one of the things that I was looking at were the Deadheads, the followers of the band that I wrote songs for, who seemed to have a kind of community. And I wanted to know more about them, but the problem was that if I went among them and tried to study them, I was sort of a godlike being as far as they were concerned, and it would completely alter what I was finding out. So I wanted to study them without being so readily apparent. And I was muttering about how this was my objective, and somebody said, well, you could watch them on the internet. I didn't know what the internet was. This is in 1984. I said, what would that be? And she explained that there was this thing that I could attach my computer to where I could see them having conversations. And so I got myself a 300 baud modem and attached it to my compact luggable. And then she gave me an internet account and a TimeNet number. And I hacked my way onto the internet, which was really, it was not user-friendly. If you're a rancher in Wyoming, don't have anybody around to help you with this. I got online, and I had this religious conversion almost overnight. I felt, yeah, the Deadheads were there, and it was interesting to study them, but what was also there was a kind of new society that I'd never seen before. There was a social space that looked like it was infinitely capacious and borderless and could eventually accept all of humanity, and in which it was going to be very difficult to impose any laws, and it was going to be very difficult to use the notions of property an identity and culture that had been problematic for humanity most of its history. And I was, I felt like it was my mission from that point forward to try to spread that, the dimensions of that social space, and to keep it as open and conducive to human thought and liberty as I could make it. Because I could see, even in 1984 or 5, that there was the possibility that if it grew enough, it would make it so that anybody anywhere could answer any question to which there was an answer. That if he had curiosity, he would be able to find the necessary fulfillment of that curiosity, because all of human knowledge would be available to him. This is not a crazy idea. It wasn't a crazy idea then. It's not a crazy idea now. I was pretty naive about how that was all going to come to pass, but I just felt like it would. And I got online, and I was having a really good time learning about things that I never would have run across before, studying the technology of the internet, and getting around people who were the kind of folks that are in that book, hackers. Now, hacker, in those days, meant somebody who actually created digital technology. It didn't mean somebody who broke into computers. Those were called crackers. But, you know, Steve Wozniak was a hacker, for example. There were a great many wizardly people that had created the internet, and I found myself among them, and I really enjoyed their company. And at one point, Harper's Magazine had a forum, very prescient of them. This was in 1989. They gathered together a forum on something called The Well, which was a bulletin board that was kind of a salon in cyberspace. And they got a bunch of us to talk about the social consequences of computing, the things that I'd been starting to write about and think about. Things having to do with hacking into systems and what knowledge ought to be forbidden, and privacy and freedom of expression. And they invited a bunch of teenage computer crackers from something called the Legion of Doom, what they called them, to this discourse. And I found these kids kind of scary and distasteful, as old hippies tend to think young punks are. And at one point, I said basically something that was true, which was that if you took their modems and switched them for skateboards, it wouldn't make much difference. And this irritated them, and so they downloaded my entire credit file into the conference. And behaved as though they had the means to change it permanently so that I'd never have credit again. Well, this was a bluff. But the fact that they'd gotten my whole credit file in the first place was terrifying. So I wrote something in the forum. I said, well, we've just exceeded the bandwidth of this medium. I would appreciate it if you guys would give me a call. And I won't insult your intelligence by giving you my phone number, which was listed, but they didn't know that. And I knew that they would call me immediately just to show me how quickly they could get my phone number, and they did. And when they did, I had a bunch of kids calling from different payphones in New York, none of whose voices had changed yet. They were all 13, 14 years old. They were just kids. And suddenly I felt completely different about them. I felt like these were people I understood. They were just like I had been at that age. They were trying to violate some symbolic forbidden because they couldn't really violate the forbidden they wanted yet. And I had a great affinity for them. And next thing I knew, I was kind of like their scoutmaster.
I would have these regular phone calls where 20 kids from the New York area would call in from various payphones, and we would talk. But then at one point, one of their number came home and found that his 12-year-old sister was being held at gunpoint by about 6 members of the American Secret Service. And they were removing every single electronic item from the house, you know, clock radios, all of his Metallica tapes. I mean, they didn't know what they were looking for, but they were going to clean it all out. And I called around and found that most of them had been hit in much the same way, as though they were major criminals or terrorists or something. And I thought, well, maybe these kids are actually more dangerous than I thought if the government's going to come on in this way. And I started collecting information about what was happening. And somewhere in there, I got a phone call from Agent Richard Baxter of the Rock Springs, Wyoming field office of the FBI. And I knew Agent Baxter. He had previously helped me recover some livestock of mine that had been stolen. And he wasn't a bad guy. He was certainly good on things like livestock theft. And he calls up and he says that he needed to talk to me in person. He couldn't discuss it over the phone, and that it was quite urgent. That is not a good phone call. I said, come on up, which was about 100 miles. And I awaited to find out what it was going to come down with Agent Baxter. You know, and being a songwriter for a notorious acid rock band, you know, means that you've got a lot of friends that probably are doing something illegal, and I was worried about that. When he showed up, he was much more nervous than I was, and it took him a long time to explain what it was that he was trying to investigate, which was that somebody had taken some of the source code for the ROM chips in the Apple Macintosh and had spread it around on floppy disks in protest of Apple's closed system architecture and threatened to reveal the entire body of source code. If Apple didn't open up the Macintosh so that people could change it and be creative inside it. And I had attended a conference called the Hackers Conference that had been convened because of that book. And the FBI didn't know that hackers meant hackers like that. They thought that hackers meant computer terrorists. And they also had been convinced that what was going on with this particular instance, which called itself the New Prometheus League, though Agent Baxter kept calling it the New Prosthesis. And that was, you know, that was just one of the things that he had wrong. I mean, he was a wealth of misinformation. And I spent about an hour and a half explaining to him what had happened so that then I could start explaining to him why I was not likely to be the person who had done it. And I had this terrible feeling. I've never been comfortable when I see well-armed, insecure, not very bright people with guns wandering around in a place where there are people I care about. And this was one of those moments. And suddenly what was happening to my little friends in the Legion of Doom had a context that was much larger. I realized that the government of the United States had invaded this thing that I had not regarded as a place yet, but I started calling. I tried various different names for it. Data sphere, infospace. And then I remembered that I'd read a book by a guy named William Gibson in which he had something called cyberspace, that I liked the sound of that. It was especially ironic that cyber means control and there wasn't any space. So it had that going for it. So I realized that the government was going to try to invade cyberspace. And I cared about cyberspace, so I started calling it by a name so it could have a political identity. And I wrote this piece that we were shown at great length on the screen earlier. I wrote the beginning of it, I should say. By this time, by the time that edition came out, it had several editions, but it was read by a guy named Mitch Kapor, who had started Lotus 1-2-3, and was a very wealthy computer software entrepreneur. And he had actually also had his own sort of alarming moment with the FBI, because he was one of the people that had been sent one of these disks. The FBI had visited him, and it had been so disturbing to him that he hadn't even told his wife about it. But suddenly he had a support group in me. So he called me up from his plane, which he was flying with his pilot across the United States, and asked if he could land in Wyoming and come and talk to me about what I knew about the Secret Service, the Legion of Doom, several other cases that I knew quite a bit about. There was a kid named Craig Nydorf that had been badly dealt with by the government. There was a role-playing games company in Austin, Texas that had been basically closed down for trying to put out a role-playing game called Cyberpunk. And we looked at what was going on, and we felt like, well, this is just simply a mistake on the part of the government. They don't realize that the First Amendment applies to bits just as much as it applies to print on paper. And they don't realize that a computer hard disk is no different from a filing cabinet in terms of the rights that you're given by the Fourth Amendment not to have undue search and seizure of your property. So we figured that what we would do is hire some fancy civil liberties lawyers in New York and take the government to court, and that would be that. And we'd have that matter clarified. And we did, and we started to make a lot of fuss. And we'd just gotten started at this when I got an email from a kid who, in what was still the Soviet Union, who had crawled across the border into Finland in order to send me this message, and said he'd heard what we were doing trying to get the Constitution to apply to the internet, and he wondered, what about people like him where they didn't have a constitution? And I realized that, you know, in cyberspace, the Bill of Rights was a set of local ordinances, and that it was going to go on being so, that it was going to be very difficult to convey any rights for the same reason that it was going to be very difficult to impose any laws, because it was hard to find the body, the physical body, of those whom you would donate, those you would grant those rights to, or who you would make suffer at the expense of your laws. And Mitch and I realized that what we were going to have to do was to think a lot about the architecture of the net itself, rather than assuming that law was going to take care of the matter, because it probably wouldn't in many cases, and be less and less applicable as time went on. We were going to have to see that the architecture of the net was shaped in such a way that it naturally was conducive to those characteristics of open expression, freedom of communication, access to knowledge, and all of the values that we felt were being promised by this environment. And what we hadn't been at that very long before we realized that it was going to be a very long process, because we looked up and we saw that what was really happening was that the internet was about to ask a whole bunch of questions of society in general that was going to cause a fundamental renegotiation of just about every single power relationship on the planet. All of those assumptions that really had been in place since the birth of monotheism, where there was this great unquestionable authority with God on top and you on the bottom, and a whole bunch of guys generally in the stack, was about to become very horizontal. And the net was going to ask questions of every canon that was out there to cling to. And there were going to be a lot of people that wouldn't like that. And they would come up with a broad variety of ways to keep that from happening and to protect the industrial period, the nation state, the Catholic Church, whatever power there might be, against the corrosive spreading tendrils of this godless internet. And interestingly enough, I think that in the 20 some odd years since then, we have been able to keep the governments of the physical world more or less at a draw in terms of their ability to actually exert themselves over the internet, really. They fancy themselves to be much better at it than they are. But the great thing about the internet is that it truly is a frontier, in the sense that the technology is constantly creating new spaces and new tunnels underneath other tunnels and new ways of getting around whatever it is that you need to get around. And so even as the institutions that showed themselves to be completely clueless at first start to get semi-clueful, we get smarter all the time. And most of the people on my side of this game are young people, whereas most of the people on the other side of the game are older. And the demographics alone indicate to me that one of these days, our side will be alive and their side will be dead. I mean, I take some comfort in this. I'll be among the dead, but I feel very confident about the future. But in the meantime, there were a lot of things that had to get tended to that couldn't wait. And so Mitch and I started the Electronic Frontier Foundation to deal with all of these various things. And it occurred to me in about 93 that, you know, they were already using terrorism and child pornography and drugs as being reasons why they had to come in and control the internet. But there was another horseman of the anti-apocalypse that I started to see with increasing frequency, and that was copyright law. Now, as a songwriter, I'd always thought the copyright law was kind of a good thing, since it assured me some royalties for my work. And I was buying the general notion that copyright law exists to reward creators. But it dawned on me at about that point that first of all, that if you were going to actually have free speech in cyberspace, you couldn't have people owning it. That there was a necessary... It was actually a contradiction. I don't believe in contradictions much. I think they're usually paradoxes. But there was a contradiction between owning speech and having it be free. And I wrote something called The Economy of Ideas, which I published in Wired, which I'd helped start by that point, in which I said that it was actually simply impractical to go on trying to monetize expression in the way that we were, because it wasn't anything like property. Property's pretty simple. I mean, if something is a piece of property and you take it from me, I don't have it anymore. You do. But this is not true of information. I mean, if I have a song and you take it from me, then both of us have it. And in fact, it is not necessarily reduced in its value because of that. Indeed, it may have increased. I realized that you know, unlike the economy of stuff, about which Adam Smith was essentially correct, that there was a relationship between scarcity and value, that it might well be the case that in the economy of thought, there was a relationship between familiarity and value. And I actually had good reason to believe that was practically true, because the band that I wrote for had made a practice of letting people tape our concerts. In the beginning, you know, we found out that they were taping concerts, and we'd been against the idea because we felt in some miscellaneous way that they were stealing from us. They were pirating our music, I guess. We didn't have that clever concept to label them with, but we were kicking people out of concerts if they had tape recorders. But we didn't like kicking people out of concerts. I mean, we were nice guys, basically. At least at that point we were. And we didn't feel right about it, so we decided to let them stay. And we felt like we were probably losing money, but we weren't in it for the money, which was easy for us to say at that time because we weren't making very much. So what happened, very interesting, we invented viral marketing, completely inadvertently. The tapes that the Deadheads made of our concerts became a much more pervasive and useful tool for disseminating our work than anything that Warner Brothers could ever have come up with by way of marketing or advertising. And we had all gotten pretty well off as a consequence. I mean, the Deadheads had become a cult to such a degree that we could fill any stadium in the United States anytime we wanted to, largely by hauling our audience around with us. But the fact was we could do that because they had become so devoted to these tapes, which were different every time. And the point was, it wasn't that we knew and they knew that the art was actually the creation of the art. It was a verb, it wasn't a noun. It wasn't something you could own. It was something that existed in a relationship between the people who were playing the music and the people who were hearing it, the people who were dancing and the people and the dance that made them dance. It's a completely different way of looking at it, and it applies, I think, to practically anything that human beings can do with their minds. But it flies directly in the face of the way in which the nation states and the industrial economy thinks about value and how it creates value and how it maintains it, which is through ownership. And moreover, the idea that you could own ideas was a great way of taking the value of thought and expression, whether song or literature, away from the people who had actually created it and hold it for your own corporate interests for longer and longer periods of time. And I proposed that if we were really going to have a free internet, we were going to have to come up with a different way to monetize expression. And that shouldn't be terribly hard. It was just like any other service. We already knew how to monetize services, and we could make that transition fairly gracefully, or so I thought. Everybody in this room knows how gracefully that transition has not been made. You know, in spite of the fact that the record industry would have done very well for themselves to recognize the wisdom of what I was telling them in 93, they fight it hammer and tong to this day, and in the process, they're doing their best to be the reason why it is necessary for the governments of the physical world to impose themselves on cyberspace. That, and kiddie porn, and terrorism, and drugs, though copyright is the primary tool that they use. So, I think it was in 96, I went to the World Economic Forum. I was invited to speak there. This was at a point when I would say 90% of the people who came to the World Economic Forum were unaware of the internet. But unfortunately, the United States Congress had become aware enough of it that they had passed something called the Communications Decency Act, which would have made it a felony to type fuck online. Difficult to enforce and problematic in many ways. But nevertheless, it had been passed. And on the day that I was at the World Economic Forum, it was signed into law by Bill Clinton, who should have known better. And so I wrote something called the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. I dashed this off. I was half drunk. I was at a dance with a bunch of graduate students from the University of Geneva that the World Economic Forum had hired to be kind of like geishas in Armani suits. And I wasn't taking the matter terribly seriously, But I thought that it was good to state what I think is still true, which is that physical world governments are going to have a very difficult time imposing themselves on this domain. They always will. It's just hard to do, and we can make it increasingly hard to do, and will and have. So it wasn't a declaration of independence in the same way that the American Declaration of Independence suddenly severed the king. It was more like a statement of something that I felt already existed. And over the course of time since, that document gets trotted out either to praise or to vilify. But more often as not, somebody will start off an article quoting it and then say, see how wrong he was. Now we know that governments can actually impose themselves on the internet. I don't think we know that yet. I honestly don't. I do think that they are getting better and better at trying, and they are getting more and more desperate, and they're doing things like trying to pass international treaties in secret that require internet service providers to simply make you voiceless in cyberspace if you have been known to have some copyrighted material that you've passed around. That you can be made a non-person. And that in fact, your ISP, your internet service provider, can be made a non-ISP by a simple declaration that has no right of appeal. They're trying things like this. Fortunately, they almost passed something like this in the United States, and we caught them in time and stopped it. But they're still circulating. Even as we speak, something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is being negotiated entirely in secret and has most of these provisions, to the best of our knowledge, still embedded. So that is the whole history. I mean, that's longer-winded than I meant to be. But within that, there are a huge number of things that we can talk about with regard to the relationship between government and the internet, but also with regard to order, human society, ethics, and the internet, which are still questions that I think have to be addressed. I mean, that in the absence of law, which has largely still been absent, other things have happened that I think almost everybody agrees are bad things. I mean, the fact that email is almost unusable these days because of the amount of spam that it gets. The fact that malware is ridiculously widespread. The fact that identity theft is very common. There are a number of things that I think genuinely are wrong and even probably criminal, but we don't really have the means to stop them unless we can start coming up with social compacts amongst ourselves that really have some force in the same way that the Code of the West seemed to have real legitimate force among my rancher neighbors and myself back in Wyoming. Okay, that said, now I want to just open this up and talk.
Yes, we do have a microphone here, and I think we should accept your invitation of having a discussion with you here in this room. But I think before we do so, I think we should still give John Perry an applause for Kevin Wallace. All right. The mic is here. It has a cord. We hope for a cordless one, but I can still move down the aisle. Is there anyone who'd like to have a question or say something? All right. I think we can start with Pete. Go ahead.
One thing that occurred to me a while back was that the copyright laws of today seem to assign property to ideas and expressions, but it doesn't seem to really text-wise assign value to it. In Norway, at least, we have a property register where all the properties of Norway, land property, is registered. We have a register with cars. And if you own a car or a land, piece of land, you will get a value put on it. And if it's more than your debt, you will actually have tax collected from it. Why don't we have that for expressions which are assigned copyright? I suspect that would rein in the freedom of, the way copyright has been extended over and over, because there is no really downside to having copyright. If you would be taxed, I think that would be an interesting change in the way copyright works. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, the reason that you don't have those kinds of things adhering to so-called intellectual property is that it's not really property. And in fact, nobody, you used that term, the very term intellectual property, didn't exist until sometime in the early 70s. Up to that point, people regarded what was being protected, or the rights that were being conveyed by copyright, to be a limited monopoly on expression in some mechanical medium. There was a period during which you had the exclusive right to publish something on paper. And that was a temporary right and usually didn't last very long. And it was a necessity largely because it was expensive to reproduce most of human expression. Literature, especially scientific literature, was costly, and you had to have an industrial process, and you had to protect that process. The point where they started calling it property was the point where those conveyances, those containers for this stuff started to go away, and they needed to think of it in some other way to maintain their control over it. They started calling it intellectual property. They started calling it content, which ironically, nobody used the word content until the containers started to evaporate. But the reason that you don't have those kinds of things is because information, expression, it's not like physical goods in the sense that you can't place a value on it. The value of thought is entirely contextual. What is valueless to one person is extremely valuable to the next. So you can't actually place a property value on it.
Should we remove copyright law altogether?
Well, I mean, I think we have to go through a transition. If you know about Creative Commons, I had something to do with creating that, and I think Creative Commons, for those of you who don't know what it is a way of assigning some rights, but not all rights. So that if, for example, in my case, I want people to be free to record and pass around my songs, but I don't want them to make commercial use of them, then I can withhold the right for commercial use. Or I can say they can sample from them, but not reproduce the entire song. Or various regimes. And I think that we gradually back ourselves away from this method and towards a method increasingly where we realize that it's about trying to gather around the expressor, the venue of expression, and create the relationship and turn that relationship into the thing that is valued. But this is going to be a fairly lengthy transition. It's not going to happen immediately.
Well, Einstein, he's young, he can still live through most of it. You have a question?
I have a question about the use of words. You're a writer, or used to be, maybe still is. I always use the word intellectual monopolies. I try to use subsidies. Some people call things a pirate website, whereas I mean, they're maybe accessory to copyright infringement. I use the words like authorized services versus unauthorized services, because in this, do they need authorization, etc.? So, and there are a lot of these words, and words are important, very important, because not only do they shape the discourse and the mentality of those in it, and they frame the course, but it also refers to laws. Like when you he's an unlawful enemy combatant, or he's a, it wasn't an assassination, it was targeted killing, etc. All of these things. So my question is to you, to what extent should we, digital freedom fighters, keep bugging them about the use of words?
I think words are really critical in this area, and it's actually the use of words in this misleading way that has gotten them as far as it has. I mean, I'll go back to content. If you hear somebody use the word content, you know they're on the wrong side, even if they think that they're not. Because content assumes, I mean, content is a noun. It assumes a physicality to the stuff that it's talking about that the stuff it's talking about doesn't have. It doesn't have a container. It is not contained in something. It's expression. It's as I say, it's a verb. It's not a noun. There, another word is consumer. People do not consume information in the same way that they consume a hamburger. You know, I mean, you know what happens when you consume a hamburger. You know, it's not what happens when you hear a song, really. It isn't. And piracy is another word. I mean, you know, the idea that sharing human knowledge is tantamount to plunder on the high seas is just one of the most grotesque misuses of language. We've reclaimed the word pirate in the same way that gay people have sort of reclaimed the word queer. But, you know, that it's nothing like piracy. Piracy, actually, is what the record industry was doing to the musicians all along. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons they chose that term, was because it applied so well to what they'd already been up to.
That's a good one. Okay, we have several people on the list. First, Tug Out.
Thanks. I'd like to pick your brain a bit about something you touched on to, the ISP's role in the internet. And as you said, governments around the world are now trying to implement several types of legislation that will mandate either ISPs, hosting providers, or whatever, to act as their servants in certain respects. What are your thoughts on how those companies should behave, position themselves, etc., to align with their customers versus the governments and all that, and especially in the fact that they're across the border and lots of different legislation?
Well, you know, a lot of the... I mean, a good ISP is practically invisible both to its users and the government and itself. But there are obviously significant issues around that because of domain name identification and ISP numbers and that kind of thing. I think, you know, we have to really re-examine the architecture in terms of how the domain name system works and how ISP numbers are assigned and how fluid they can be. I mean, there is software that I'm sure some of you know called Tor, which makes it so that you can't trace a message. You can have the necessary interactivity that is required for a packet to be sent out across the internet, but you can't find out where it came from by examining the packet at the end, as you can with everything else. Those are the kinds of things. I, several years ago, gave a speech in Iceland and encouraged them to make Iceland the Switzerland of bits, and they are actually right now trying to set up a regime in Iceland called the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, which would basically make it so that any information that somebody wanted to have offline can be put in Iceland safely, and that servers can be running in Iceland with relative impunity, because the way in which the physical world operates on cyberspace is to find the server, and the server is generally in a location. Fortunately, it's getting harder and harder to find the server anyway because of the cloud. But you know, there is still that line of accountability that we need to make more and more obscure. And the means are at hand. We're doing it, but we have to be very thoughtful about it and be mindful of the tools that are available to us.
Good. I think we like the name Thor in this country, in Iceland too. The old Nordic gods, you know, they're coming back to protect us. We have a question from the front here. Could you just say who you are?
Lee Bygrave. Thanks very much for a fascinating story. And my question to you is, you know, looking at, here, listening to your story, you've been very much focused on government as a potential threat. There are other actors in this equation out there, and I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit on perhaps a bit more of the corporate world, what you see. I mean, this is raised by your question initially, you know, Google, Apple. What's your take on that? I mean, are they to be put in the same category as the FBI and other government agencies? Or are they?
Well, they're worse.
Well,
I mean, for what, you know, at least with governments, you know, in the case of, say, mine, we do have this document, which, you know, we pretend to observe, that holds the government to a certain standard. The Bill of Rights is basically a set of bugs that were inserted into the governmental software to make it so that it didn't run really well. And a lot of countries have something kind of like that. Well, a corporation has, you know, a terms of service that is usually, if you printed it out, 60 or 70 pages long, and that you pretend to have read so that you can launch the application or get into the thing that you want there. You click a box, which attests that you have just read, you know, something that gives away, you know, the rights of your children in perpetuum or whatever it does. I mean, so corporations actually, also because they own much of the infrastructure, are much scarier to me, by and large, than government. They're furthermore much better at it. I mean, government goes on being kind of dynamically anti-clueful. I mean, they're just dopey about this stuff. It doesn't fit their model well. But you know, an organization like Google, you know, which I have much to say. I knew the guys that started Google when it was still in alpha. And, you know, at that point, I saw that they had something that was just like, it was the Holy Grail. I said, this is fantastic. How are you going to make money on this? And they said, we don't know, but we're smart guys. We'll probably figure it out. You know, so that was the way in which they proceeded. And then, you know, they didn't seem to care about the money either, since they weren't making any. And then they said that their motto was going to be, don't be evil. Well, that's like, you know, there's no way you can say that you're not going to be evil and not become evil sooner or later. But I will say this of the people at Google. They actually go on making a genuine effort not to be evil, and they're very smart and thoughtful. I mean, if we were going to entrust a role as important as this has been to any single human being that I know, Eric Schmidt is probably the best philosopher king to have been given that job. But there is also the beast that is Google. Unfortunately, the beast that is Google, interestingly enough, consists of everybody who uses it. I mean, it is literally an organism of all the minds that are searching it at any given moment, and it becomes more and more like that and adapted to that all the time. We are it and it is us. Now, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. It is certainly an adaptive thing. And it actually serves the interests of Google to know a great deal about us, but it also serves the interests of Google to leave us alone. In no way is it in the interest of the Google organisms about what they express. So we have that kind of on our side. Now, Apple, on the other hand, really is kind of evil and has been all along. I say that as a devoted Mac user. And they're evil because they are increasingly creating this very beautiful designer prison. So lovely, you know, so irresistible to be in the crystalline recesses of Apple's prison that you don't notice that you can't You can't actually sell an application anywhere in there unless Apple approves it, and they don't approve a lot of things on grounds that are directly in contravention of freedom of expression. And you know, they get people to go along with this because the hardware is beautiful and the software works, unlike the alternative. So I mean, you know, there are lots of different institutions out there that they're all worrisome, but in every single instance, I think the answer is competition, and competition always arises. I mean, there was a time when people were afraid that WordPerfect was going to rule the world. You know, and about 80% of all computers were dedicated WordPerfect servers. There was a time quite recently where everybody assumed that Microsoft was going to rule the world without end. Microsoft is a joke. It's a big old joke, and it's going to go down slow. And you know, the problem is we're locked in the closet with it. And you know, it's dying slowly in the way that reptiles do. So it's doing a lot of thrashing, and it will do a great deal of harm on the way down, but it is dying. So I mean, competition comes for all these things. We just have to make certain that it does, and to prefer the competition when it shows itself.